All right, we're ready for chapters 23 and 24 of the book of Deuteronomy. We are in the second sermon, and which is starting in chapter 5 and goes through 26. So next time we will make it to the end of this second sermon and get into the third the following week. All right, in this second sermon, there are three sections as per Wiersbe's outline here. He subdivides that into the testimony, statutes, and the judgments. There's not a lot of difference, a little more technical connotation between those three statements, those three phrases, but we're in the judgments section. That's where we are. This second speech has to do with the review of the law, and that's what we're dealing with. Let's review our chapters. We won't hit every chapter in interest of some things we need to cover tonight. Chapters 1 through 4 is the first sermon. So how would you summarize the first sermon overall? Just basically, what did he say? All right, historical review, which is the first three chapters, and then chapter 4 dealt with the necessity of obedience. All right. Chapter 5 starts this off with, all right, Ten Commandments and the fear of God. And then he backs up and gives a bigger picture in chapter 6 of the law and separate people in chapter 8. Let's get down to chapter 12. What's chapter 12 about? Yeah, worshiping as God directs, the place that God chooses. That phrase will be used over and over in the Old Testament. All right, let's come to chapter 16. Annual feast. All right, let's drop down to chapter 19. Cities of refuge and witnesses and landmarks. And then chapters 21 and 22. Miscellaneous laws. We have more of that in chapter 23 and 24. We'll get to that here in just a second. Now let's back up and finish some things in chapter 22. As the bell rang last time, I got a little behind and dealt. We're starting to deal with these sexual laws. Now, I need to deal with that simply because there's some information there that will help us in interpreting some things in chapter 24. So let's quickly work through this. We're not going to spend much time here. Chapter, let me back up just to say that the chapter dealt with miscellaneous laws, responsibilities toward others, not to wear the clothes of the opposite sex, humanitarian treatment of birds, et cetera, et cetera. And then we come down to the sexual laws. So here's what we have. In 13 to 16, here was the charge and the test of a woman not being a virgin. So in interest of time, basically, that was, as you recall, if you haven't read that this week, was where a man marries a woman, and then he makes the charge she wasn't a virgin. And if it's a false charge, what happens? She can bring, the parents bring proof of her virginity, that she was a virgin, and if it's true that she was a virgin, then he is to pay the parents, and then he cannot divorce her all the days of his life. But if it is true, his charge, what happens? She's to be taken out and to be stoned, down at verse 21. All right, verse 22, a man with a married woman, If they are caught in adultery, this is important because of chapter 24 a little bit later. You'll see how that plays in just a moment. But what happens if here's a man and a woman, a man with a married woman, and they're committing adultery and they're caught? They both are to be stoned to death. Verse 23 through 20 and 24, here's a betrothed virgin and a man lie together. They both are to be put to death. And we made this point last time, I think, that a betrothal had the same strong binding power as a marriage, though they were not yet married. But it had the same binding power. Evidence, Matthew chapter 1, along that line. Now at verse 25 through 27, here is a man that rapes a betrothed virgin. He is to be put to death and she's not. Why? All right. Yeah, and notice at verse 20, Let's get verse 20, verse 23. If a young woman who is a virgin is betrothed to a husband and a man finds her and he lies with her, then you shall bring them both out of the gate and you shall stone them to death. They stone them both if that's found out, because she did not cry out. That's willing participation. That's why she would be stoned. But if not, then we see later that only he is to be stoned. Now, verse, let's see, I'm ready for 28 and 29. A man with a virgin that's not betrothed, here's what's to be done. What was to be done in that case? If a man finds a young woman that's not betrothed and he seizes her and they're found out, he is to give 50 shekels to her father. And because he humbled her, and he is to marry her and not permitted to divorce her. And then in the case of incest, in verse 30, you cannot take your father's wife nor uncover your father's bed. It's probably not a reference to his mother, but a father's second wife, perhaps a younger woman, as we might have in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. And I know that's a hurried look at that, but you'll see the significance of us going over verse 22, particularly when we get to chapter 24. All right, let's get underway with chapter 23. Chapter 23 deals with the purity of the congregation and the purity of the camp itself, particularly in 9 to 14. But even 17 and 18 has to do with purity. In fact, the whole chapter deals with purity in some shape, form, or fashion. So let's get underway with verses 1 to 8. Those that are not allowed to enter the congregation. That's caused some discussion among commentators. What does that mean when we get to, we'll talk about who they are in just a moment. But let's start at the end of verse 23. They shall not enter the congregation of the Lord. And then here's another class of people that shall not enter the congregation of the Lord. Here's another class of people or group of people that cannot enter the congregation of the Lord. What does that mean? Well, some think that refers to the worship gathering, the holy convocation, the assembly. And so as they would assemble for worship at some of the feasts that were mentioned in chapter 16, these annual feasts, that may be what that refers to. They're not allowed to come to that. They can be a part of Israel, can be among the children of Israel, but they cannot come to the holy convocation. Pulpit says it had to do with covenant fellowship. I'll come back to that. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggest it has to do with public honors. I think Pulpit probably hit the nail on the head closer than anyone else. And the reason I say that, because he talks about the Ammonite and the Moabite could not be a part of this. I don't think he's saying that Ammonite and the Moabite can be a part of Israel, but they can't come to the holy convocation. But they can't be a part of the fellowship of Israel. They can't be a part of the camp of Israel. And so I take that's what that means. This seems kind of extreme. Seems kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? It's extreme, or it seems like it goes to great lengths. And yet this is not New Testament law, but yet this was part of God's maintaining the purity of his people. And we'll see more about why that may be the case in just a moment. But I have to interpret verse 1 in light of similar things are said about the Ammonite and the Moabite and et cetera. Does that make sense? That helps me interpret that, at least in my mind. So let's talk about the first one here. Here is one who is castrated, or as the New King James, emasculated, either by crushing or mutilation, he shall not enter the congregation. Perhaps that's for the why is that? Well, we don't have to know why. If God just said, if here is one that's happened to, they're not to be a part of the congregation. Why? Well, it may be to discourage the disfigurement of the body. Colin Dalich suggests that that this was the mutilation, whether of his own will or against his will, it was a mutilation of the nature of man, and God was trying to maintain the purity, thus the theme here of the purity within the congregation. So whether he could help that or not, whether he could, it was by mutilation, or whether he did this to himself, or had it done, or whether somebody by cruelty did that, he was to be excluded. And I'm going to leave it at that. Starting at verse 2, or in verse 2, one of illegitimate birth should not enter the congregation. Why was that? Well, we don't again have to know why. God just said don't do that. It's probably to discourage that frivolous and extramarital or premarital relationships. that you might think twice about it, that if we have a child in this relationship and a child comes, they're going to be excluded from they can't be a part of Israel. So it may make you think twice. Chapter 24 is going to do some thinking twice, and we'll talk about a little bit later. Now, this visiting under the 10th generation, some commentators say that they think that may mean literally 10 generations, and in the 11th generation, they can then allow them to enter. I don't think so. I think it is 10 being like the number 7, a complete number. And by the time you got to that 10th generation, the 11th generation, it's going to be hard to accept them. I think it's the idea, and I don't have the time to trace that, but look up 10, the number of 10, throughout the Pentateuch, and you'll find these 10 times, or 10 times something was done, which has to do with perpetual things being done. I don't have time to trace those right now, but nonetheless, you can do that on your own. So I do think that has reference to a forever. So the question comes, and I don't have time to explore this, does the term forever is used synonymous with that in this context in verses 1 to 8? Does the word forever define the 10 generations, or does the 10 generations define the forever? And so you can work that out in your own mind. I think the forever defines the 10 generations is the case. Now let's go to 3 to 6. The Ammonite and the Moabite would be prohibited. This would seem to keep them from intermingling, at least on the east side of Jordan, mingling and so becoming so powerful that they could overpower Israel themselves. That would seem to be the case, but again, we're not told exactly why here, what the end goal was, but you do that for 10 generations as well. Now, the Ammonites and the Moabites both were descendants of Lot. They worked together in the case here that's mentioned in verses 3 and 4, and the case where they sought to bring a curse upon Israel through Balaam. That's found, you might flag if you don't have center reference column or footnotes, in Numbers 22 through 24. Those three chapters deal with the cursing, the attempt to curse by Balaam. So because they didn't help you, verse 4, they tried to curse you, but God loved you and blessed you, you shall not seek their peace nor their prosperity all your days forever. But he just mentioned for 10 generations. Here forever, I think, is defining for me the 10 generations. Make sense? All right. Now let's go to 7 and 8. What's the deal with the Edomites? And who were they, first of all? Descendants of Esau. What about them? You shall not abhor the Edomite because he's your brother, because he's a descendant of Esau, all right? Nor the Egyptian. Why? You were an alien, a sojourner in their land, and so don't abhor them. So, but you can't allow them to come in. The children of the third generation born may enter the congregation. So they had strangers among them. Traveled among them. There was a mixed multitude, but that third generation, they could. So there is an end to that, which is in contrast, seemingly, to the 10th generation, which I take to be forever, perpetual. Make sense? So these are just laws that have to do with who's going to be allowed to enter the congregation. Now, you may think that's only the corporate worship. And some commentators think that and have at that. I'm not going to argue against that. I think it probably, as pulpit suggests, the covenant fellowship. They're not allowed to be a part of the fellowship of Israel. Make sense? All right. That's the purity of Israel itself, the congregation. Now, this has to do with the purity of the camp. And seemingly, we've been talking about war in the previous chapters, previous two chapters, 21 and 22, talked about war. And this may have to do with wartime, though it may have had application otherwise. In other words, some present this section, 9 to 14, as this is instruction for the host of the camp. In other words, those who are left behind and those who are in control of that. Here's what you do in the camp when men are gone to war. And evidence of that would be verse 9, that when an army goes against your enemies, then keep yourself from every wicked thing. It's kind of a broad statement. So as they go to war, as you're out in war, stay away from idolatry, stay away from harlotry, stay away from, and you just keep naming. If it's an evil thing, you stay away from that as you go to war. But as you're at home and in the camp, you also stay away. Now, here's another thing, verses 10 and 11. This, and we have this several times in the Old Testament, some delicate things. Some of the guys will tell me they really hate to teach the Song of Solomon. Well, let me tell you, Song of Solomon didn't deal with some of the things Deuteronomy deals with, or Isaiah for that matter. There's some delicate things there. So here in verses 10 and 11 is just simply a case that if a man among them has an unclean occurrence, as some call it, some translations even mention an emission at night, then he is unclean the next morning, and he stays unclean and goes outside the camp until he washes himself, and then he can come back into the camp, maintains purity. We're going to leave it at that. Verse 12 through 14 is creating a place for a restroom. So as they go to war, this would be the case, and I take this as also the case while they're back at home in the camp, but particularly as they're going to war, starting at verse 12, you shall have a place outside the camp where you go out. And so when you go out and there is refuge, you need to cover that. So they take something of a spade or a shovel or a paddle, and they were to cover that. Now this is interesting here. Because of verse 14, let me get my wording here found in the text. For the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp. Well, now God sees everything. And God knows everything. God knows what, and I'm not trying to be graphic here, but as he goes outside the camp, God saw what he was doing. God saw him cover it. God saw all of that. But this is a lesson about respect for that which is holy and for God. If God's going to be in the camp, and God's coming among us in the camp, even though God sees and knows everything, there's respect for God. Does that make sense? You say, how do you know that's? Because that's what the text said. That's what verse 14 just said. That the Lord walks in the midst of the camp to deliver you and give your enemies over to you. So as you're out in the battle for camp, in a camp in war, then go outside the camp, cover your refuge. God, if God's going to walk in your midst and deliver you, then show respect for your God. Make sense? And so this attitude, let me footnote here. This attitude that God doesn't care what I do and what I look like and how I act and how I dress, because God sees everything. God does see everything. But there is a principle of respect for God under certain circumstances. Does that make sense? There is respect for God, verse 14. And the warning was, if he sees something unclean, he may turn away from you. He's offended because you didn't care enough to be respectful toward him. He turns away and you're defeated by your enemy. All right. Now that's cleanliness and the purity of the camp. So the congregation needs to be pure. The camp needs to be pure. All right. Now let's talk about a runaway slave. This, again, seems to be tied perhaps to wartime. Though that's not specified at verse 15, it seems to be, that you shall not give back to his master a slave who has escaped from his master. Now, without going back, we just recently saw some cases where if a animal broke loose, you're to take it back to the master, whoever owns that. And you give back, if he's lost his coat, you give it back to him. But here's a runaway slave. I don't take this to be a slave among the children of Israel. I take it to be a slave that was a foreigner who perhaps because of oppression has fled, maybe because of the enemy pressure. This seems to have reference to wartime. And so as you're going into war, here's one that comes over to the camp, comes for refuge. He comes for asylum or whatever you want to call that. He's come for safety, away from the enemy. He's a foreigner, I take it. And when he comes, you don't send him back. What do you do with him, verse 16? You let him dwell wherever he chooses and don't oppress him. Just because he's a foreigner, he's not one of you, you let him dwell where he wishes and you don't send him back. It seems to be, again, a foreigner. You want to make that an application to a slave among the children of Israel, then have at it. I think that probably has reference to a foreigner. Yeah. Do not mistreat him. Do not oppress him. All right, now we get to an interesting thing here. Perhaps there's a tie between verse 9 and in verse 17. Is it? Maybe not. I'll just throw that out for what it may be worth. When you go out against your enemies, keep yourself from every wicked thing. Well, if every wicked thing, then idolatry would be one. Harlotry would be another, wouldn't it? Sodomy would be even another, wouldn't it? Perhaps there is a tie. I'll leave that for you to decide. At verse 17 and 18, he deals with laws concerning harlots and sodomites being excluded. And so there shall be no ritual harlot of the daughters of Israel or a perverted one of the sons of Israel. I think both cases they're talking about harlotry. And we're dealing with female and male prostitutes. Now, what's a ritual harlot? It seems to be a temple prostitute in connection with the pagan where they practice their they sell themselves at a temple in part of the service and honor of their false gods. Let's fast forward to New Testament times. By the time we're dealing with the church being established at Corinth, there were 1,000 prostitutes serving at the temple of Aphrodite. This is a pagan god. The name of the god, if I remember right, that they served simply meant sex for everyone. And so there were 1,000 prostitutes serving daily. Every day you could go to the temple of Aphrodite and there'd be 1,000 prostitutes. And engaging in their relationships was part of honoring their god, their false god. And this perhaps is what this is talking about. The English Standard talks about the cult prostitute. And so there shall be no cult prostitute or a ritual harlot of the daughters of Israel, nor a perverted one of the sons of Israel. And that's the idea of a one who practices sodomy. Look at your footnote if you have the New King James. The word simply means one practicing sodomy as prostitution in religious rituals. So that's what we're dealing with. Now, they're not to have a part in Israel. Now, verse 18, I'm sorry. That you should not bring the hire of a harlot or the price of a dog. Now, he talks about the same two people. He talks about the harlot and the perverted one, the one who practices sodomy. So notice the biblical term. These are not my terms. These are God's terms. That he, as he describes sodomy, homosexuality, he called them perverted ones, and the other term was dogs. Now, since they're prostitutes, that means they're selling themselves. So you should not bring the hire of a harlot or the price of a dog to the house of the Lord for any vowed offering. That's an abomination. So you think of the idea, well, let's go off into war or go over here and you sell yourself into harlotry. And then you bring the money and you give it to the temple of the Lord. That'd be like a prostitute going out walking the streets at night and then coming in on Sunday morning and said, I've made a lot of money this week and I'd like to give half of that to the Lord. God doesn't want it. It's an abomination. Or you gamble and you have some winnings and so you give that to the congregation. Give that to the Lord. God said, that's an abomination. Don't do that. God said, I abhor that. Make sense? All right. Now, I'm trying to get my way down to chapter 24. We've got to talk about that, so let's continue on. Verses 19 to 25, here's obligations of respect toward other people. So this will finish this chapter. Do not charge interest from a brother. I'm going to just summarize that one, 19 and 20. We've seen that before. You cannot charge interest of... Let me look for my wording here at verse 19. You should not charge interest of your brother, interest on food or money or food, etc., and lend that to him. One commentator made the observation, and I think he may be right, that there would be those among the children of Israel who had money, and there'd be those who were poor. And so as you lend to the poor, Don't charge interest on that. Lend them what they need. Give them the food. Give them the money that they need. Don't charge interest. That I don't think that had reference to loaning something to somebody in a business fashion. That you have money and here's a man who's wanting to invest in some land. He's not in poverty. He's not poor, but he borrows some of your money. There may be interest charged there. But this had to do with lending to the poor. Don't charge interest of your brother. 21 to 23. What is that about? Yeah, made a promise. Keep your promise. You make a vow of what you're going to pay. You pay it. You have a vow of what you're going to do. You do it. When you make a vow, I'm going to give this to God. You give it to God. You do what you say. Now, I want to get the wording of this because there's a very practical thing. Be careful what you promise. I know this is Old Testament law, but the New Testament law comes to play. Matthew 5, what is it, verse 37. James 5 and verse 12, let your yes be yes and your no, no, and no mean no. In other words, mean what you say. Look at verse 21. If you make a vow, you should not delay to pay it. Verse 21. And if you don't, then it's a sin. But if you abstain from vowing, you should not sin. In other words, you didn't make a promise. You didn't make a vow. You hadn't sinned by not doing it. But if you made a promise, now you're bound. That which is gone from your lips, you shall keep. For you voluntarily vowed it. When you utter it, your words mean something. You say, I will. You say you will pay. You say you will give. You do what you say. Your words want to mean something. How many times have you had someone make a promise? I'm going to do this. I'm going to pay for this. I'm going to do X, Y, Z, and they don't do it. Keep delaying. All right, verse 24 and 25 to finish the chapter. The point there is, you go into your neighbor's field or go to his vineyard. Can you eat? Yes. Can you gather and put it in something? No, because you're beginning to reap and save it for later. Eat what you can consume, and you're welcome to do that, but don't start taking things such as a sickle or a container with you. That's not to be done. So that's respect for others. Make sense? That has to do with purity too. That is, we're maintaining a purity of our respect for others, our relationships. All right. So that's what chapter 23 is about. Purity of the congregation, about those that enter, the cleanliness of the camp, the runaway slave, harlots excluded, and sodomites excluded, and obligations of respect. Let's go to chapter 24. We've got to spend a little time with verses 1 to 4. This deals with divorce, and then verses 5 to 25, miscellaneous laws. Probably, as I rethink, I have been rethinking some things in chapter 24, it should be verses 1 to 5, 6 to 22. And I'll tell you why that's the case here in just a minute. But let's talk about divorce. What we have in verses 1 to 4 is an if-then construction of the text. Deuteronomy 24 has been greatly misunderstood. How do I know? Well, when Jesus was teaching on divorce, the Pharisees said, Moses gave the command to divorce. They misunderstood right there. Because he didn't give a command to divorce, did he? There is no command to divorce in Deuteronomy 24, 1 to 4. That's what they're referring to. Jesus corrected them saying he suffered or allowed it. So I know from the very beginning, that is from looking at Matthew 19, that it's been misunderstood. It's misunderstood today in that many have taken, and I don't have time to get into this, Matthew 5, Matthew 19, and tell us that that is an explanation of Deuteronomy 24, which it is not. What they really mean, you've heard me say this many times, those who make that argument, though what they really mean is Deuteronomy 24 explains Matthew 19. And it doesn't do that either. They're talking about different laws. So what is this talking about? Here's what the text is saying. If a man puts away his wife for uncleanness, whatever that is, I'll define that in a moment. But I really don't care what it is. I don't care what it is. Sounds trivial to me, probably to you, that for me to say that. But there's a reason why I say, I don't care what it is. But if a man puts away his wife for uncleanness, and, number two, she becomes another man's wife, and that second man puts her away or he were to die, then the first husband can't have her back. Now, I'm going to go through that again. But what I want you to understand is verses 1 to 4 is trying to discourage trivial divorce. Think twice before you put her away. Because if you put her away and she goes and marries another man and then he gets rid of her or he dies and you say, well, you know, I shouldn't have done that, you can't have her back. Think twice before you put her away. Verse 5, let me get ahead of myself. I'm not through with 1 to 4, but verse 5 deals with marriage and building respect in that marriage relationship. Verses 1 to 4 is a case of disrespect in marriage. Respect for marriage, verse 5. They go together as a contrast, by the way. All right, let's go back to verses 1 to 4 now. I know what I want you to, I want to flag for you is the King James wording. I'm not saying it's a bad translation. It's a great translation. But the words I have highlighted here have misled some people, or they misinterpreted that, that if you find some uncleanness in her, then let him write her a bill of divorcement. It sounds almost as if that's, you just based on the new, on the King James, he finds some uncleanness, then that's a justifiable cause, then let him write her a bill of divorcement. That's not what the text is saying. The New American Standard says if he finds some indecency in her or uncleanness and he writes her a certificate of divorce. That's just one of the things he does. God didn't tell him to do it. That's just what he does. Does that make sense? Notice, and you might circle or highlight the word if in verse 3 and the word then. There's your if then. Casuistic law. Contingency law. New King James says the same thing, and he writes her a certificate of divorce. Not let him, or he must, or he should, if he does, and if, and then her husband cannot take her back. Make sense? You see the if then? All right, nothing is said in Deuteronomy 24 to encourage divorce and remarriage. Not one word. Not one word. It's a simple prohibition that the put-away woman cannot remarry the first husband. So here's some legal terms. Casuistic law. Look that up, and it's an if-then construction. That's all that means. The prodesis, the if, is conditions. If he puts her away for uncleanness, whatever that is, and if she becomes another man's wife, and if the second man puts her away or dies, then the apodosis is the rule. She may not remarry her first husband. That's all the text is saying. That's all that text is saying. That's all that text is saying. Now, why did I say it matters little what uncleanness is? Some say, I think that's fornication. Somebody said, I don't think it is. I don't care what it is. I really don't care. Why? Two reasons. It doesn't apply to us as New Testament law. So somebody says, do you think I have a right to divorce my wife? I think that uncleanness is what she's done. I don't care because it doesn't apply to you. You're not under that law. This law doesn't apply to us. So I really don't care what it means. And secondly, it was not a reason given with God's approval. So if uncleanness was the reason God said it's okay if you divorce for this cause, then I'm more interested in what that is. But that wasn't the case at all. I know it's not adultery. You say, how do you know? Because the adulterer was to be stoned, Deuteronomy 22. We just came through that. Remember that? So I know it's not adultery. You say, well, maybe it's the suspicion of adultery. There was a test for that in Numbers 5. It's not evidence that she wasn't a virgin because Deuteronomy 22 just dealt with that. So it's none of that. So what is it? The same word referred to a flaw in the land, the nakedness of the land, Genesis 49, 9, and 12. You come out to spy the nakedness of the land, the flaw in the land. I think it's just some flaw he finds in her. It's not a justifiable reason, something he don't like about her. Maybe the way she acts, it may be her attitude, it may be the way she treats him. You name it. It's a flaw he finds in her, something he doesn't like about her. And he decides to get rid of her and put her away. What was it? I don't know. Some flaw. That's the best I can do with what uncleanness is. And you say, I don't think it's a flaw. I really don't care what it is. And I'm not trying to be smart aleck. I'm just saying, I don't really care. I don't care. Let's go to Matthew 19 and look at verses 7 and 8. Because this helps me to understand what Deuteronomy 24 is about. You say, I thought that doesn't explain Deuteronomy 24. Matthew 19:9 is not an explanation of Deuteronomy 24, but Jesus does comment upon that in Matthew 19. They said, why did Moses command, that was their wording, not Jesus, but command to give a certificate of divorce to put her away? And he said, Moses, because of the hardness of your heart, permitted, King James says, suffered, hence the slide, you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it wasn't so. What I want you to see is these three differences here. These three things are different. What does Jesus mean by he suffered or permitted? That he commanded divorce? There's not a command to divorce at all in Deuteronomy 24. Did he suffer it in the sense that he allowed it with approval? There's no evidence that he approved of it. He said, if he does it, then here's what you do. Did he allow it in the sense he tolerated it? Yes, Jesus said so. Does that make sense? If then construction of law does not give permission to do anything, the law may say something like this. This won't be exact wording. If you have a wreck, then you call the police. So the law says it's all right to have wrecks. No, it didn't. The law commanded me to have wreck. No, it didn't. The law approves of you having a wreck. No, it didn't. It just said if you do, then here's what you do. Does that make sense? That's the nature of casuistic law. Deuteronomy 24 makes sense to you? Verses 1 to 4. Contingency law may be a better term for you. Casuistic law. If then construction. All the text is saying is if this happens, then she cannot come back to him. That's all it said. All right. It doesn't explain Matthew 19:9, it doesn't explain Matthew 5. Matthew 5, Matthew 19, Luke 16 does not explain Deuteronomy 24. They're separate laws. All right, let us go back to our text and the time we have and see if we can work through these miscellaneous laws. Starting with verse 5. Now, verse 5, I said, may ought to go with verses 1 to 4. And so these are not necessarily connected. These are just miscellaneous, kind of like your junk drawer, miscellaneous things going, just everything that you don't know where to put anywhere else, you jump, throw them in here. Here's miscellaneous laws. A newly married man is exempt from war for 1 year. The text doesn't say much about why, except to bring happiness to his wife, whom he has taken. Perhaps there's a contrast. Some have thought that this is not by coincidence that verse 5 followed on the heels of verses 1 to 4. Here's that trivial divorce, that lack of respect for marriage, here is respect for marriage. That the marriage is so important, he's exempt from war for a year so that he can spend time building that relationship with his wife. Does that make sense? So there's God has respect for marriage. This is not respect, verses 1 to 4 for marriage. Verse 5 is respect for marriage. Make sense? All right, verse 6. You cannot take a millstone for a pledge. He mentions the New King James mentions, let's see, verse 6. I've lost my place. Yeah, verse 6. Cannot take the lower and upper millstone. To grind meal or to grind corn, it would take two stones, and generally there was a concave. Most Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown talk about that. This concave stone that would be turned on the top of a round stone and have a hole in the top where you'd put your meal or corn, whatever it is that you're grinding, and then you grind that. And so you don't take the upper or the lower. Take either one, you've kind of defeated the purpose of being able to grind there. And one of the scholars, maybe in Pulpit or maybe in Collendale, said they would do this on a daily basis. And so if you could imagine, you take somebody's stove or their microwave, their stove and their microwave, and they don't have any means of cooking. They use it nearly every day. That's the thing. Don't take the upper stone or the lower stone, either one. You've just destroyed their means of eating. So don't do that. All right? What's the next thing? Verse 7. Kidnapper was to be killed. No place for that among the children of Israel. That evil person, put him away from among you. Verse 8 and 9. Be careful to follow the laws about leprosy. Now, this is interesting. Instead of restating the law, and why he does that, I'm not sure. This is just a bit of trivia here and interesting, that he just says, be careful to obey the laws about leprosy. The King James, what's interesting too about, and this is again a bit of trivia, at verse 8, be careful that you diligently observe. I'm reading from the New King James. And you may be reading from a New King James, and you're saying, mine said carefully. Some of them use the word carefully, and some of the New King James uses the word diligent. Remember, the New King James is updated every year. So depending on what year yours was produced as to what word. Gives me commentary on the word diligent. It means to be careful. He goes on later and said, make sure you carefully do this. Whatever the priests tell you, the Levites tell you, you carefully do that, and so that there's no outbreak of leprosy. All right, now, how do we deal with the poor? 10 through 15. You can take a pledge from him, but you're not going to take a millstone. You're not going to take something he's got to have to live. But when you go get the pledge, you're not going to barge in his house to get it. You're going to do what? Stand outside, let him bring it to you. And then if you've taken a pledge, you're going to return that to him every evening. Because it may be his garment. Maybe something he has to have to sleep. Maybe part of his bedding, etc. So you're going to take that at the end of each day. Do not oppress the poor, verse 14. And then, as Stephen just mentioned a moment ago about another matter, then each day you give him his wages. You don't delay. For he is poor and he set his heart on it, and lest he cry out against you and it be a sin. So you've got someone working for you. You've got some foreigner there. You've got whatever, and you pay what you owe, and you pay it that day. All right? See if we can finish up. Parents are not punished for their children or the children for their parents. Not saying that parents are not responsible for the training of their children. Deuteronomy 6 says so. But each one is responsible for their own sin. You might have a footnote that flags Ezekiel 18. The soul that sins, it shall die. This is talking about justice being executed. And so the child that sins, old enough to sin, they pay the price for that and they pay the penalty. Same thing with the parents. All right? Let's see what else we've got here. We don't oppress the weak. Don't interfere with things with reference to those that are weak, whether it be the fatherless or the widows, etc. Now, I'm interested in verses 19 through 22. Let's get that. What happens here? All right, yes. Leave some, and so don't get everything there is. In other words, you go in to get your grapes. Don't take every single grape. Oh, there's one over there. Let me make sure I get that. And clean everything out. There's nothing left. You leave a little bit for the poor and the fatherless and the widow, etc. You leave that for them. And remember, I'm going to finish at verse 22, that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command you to do this thing. If you remember what you were, what God's doing, God loves you, you're going to do these things. A lot of material to cover. That gets us through chapter 24. So we've got a few to go, but our time is gone, and we'll pick up next time with 25.